MacCast, Sunday, December 18th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I have a little bit of a different show for you this week. There's really not a lot of going on here at the end of the year with Apple and Mac news. We've got a couple of interesting stories. We're going to give you some updates on the AirPods. There's been some movement there, if you don't know already. Microsoft doing a little bit of Apple bashing with some of the comments they made recently on their blog. We're going to get into that. I'm going to talk pretty extensively about some analyst theories about Apple cannibalization and magic. So stay tuned for that. I think that's going to be one of my favorite parts of this episode. And then update on the MacBook Pro battery issues. But again, here at the end of the year, not a lot going on, you know, in terms of real Apple news. You've got your typical rumors about iPhones and stuff like that, but we don't need to get into that because we've been talking about that a lot, and it's going to come up more in future episodes. So we're going to update you on all of that, but more importantly, I'm going to do an update for you on Apple and accessibility, and not just me, actually myself and author, writer, editor, longtime podcaster, and a good friend of mine, Shelley Brisbane. I invited her on the show. She is an expert in the area of accessibility, and we're going to talk to her and get a little update on, you know, what is Apple doing now? What have they been doing this year? What have they updated? How are things looking in terms of Apple accessibility? And every once in a while we talk accessibility, but we really haven't sort of done an extensive update in a while. So I figure here at the end of the year, when things have slowed down a little bit, perfect time to do that. So it should be a really fun episode. I had a great time talking to Shelley, and I think you're going to enjoy it. But before we get into the episode, of course, we want to take a moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that is Drobo. Anyone who listens to the show knows that I am fanatic about backup, about archiving, about keeping my files and data safe, and Drobo is definitely part of my solution. I actually have a couple Drobos, one that's hooked up on the network that I do a lot of my archiving to, actually attached to an old Mac Mini. It's a 2006 Mac Mini. Yeah, I can't even run a modern operating system. I think it's running Snow Leopard. I can't remember the latest OS on there, but I digress. Let's get back to Drobo. Drobo is that perfect place to store all that stuff, and I actually use an app called ChronoSync with a bunch of scripts to actually automatically archive a lot of my important documents and data and files throughout the year over to that Drobo. And I do it that way because I don't want to have to get to the end of the year here and start manually sort of archiving everything. So it's happening always automatically. And I do it to the Drobo because I want it in a place where there's going to be some redundant backup, where if I need more storage, I can simply pop in a new drive. If there's a problem, what I love about the Drobo is it's got lights right on the front. It will notify me. It'll say, hey, something has happened. I can go into Drobo software, easily identify what drive is giving me a problem, what the issue is, and if I need to replace it. And you just literally swap the drive out. You can even do it while the Drobo is running. I've never done that because I'm not that brave, but you have the ability to do that. And then it will rebuild itself automatically. You don't have to worry about it. It's really the simplicity I love about the Drobo. Setting up is super simple too. You just plug it in, add in your drives, run the setup software, and you can start archiving, backing up. It even supports Time Machine. All you have to do is just have the one device and the one cable. So it's not like having a bunch of external drives where you got three or four and you're kind of trying to archive to one or the other. You can get one Drobo and use it for all of your storage needs. And like I said, expandability, when you run out of room, just add more storage. You can even swap out drives or just add additional drives, and you get all those lights and notifications. And it has all of the redundancy and security that you're going to want. Drobo uses a technology they call Beyond RAID. And to me, it just means that I don't have to worry about the RAID setup. I don't have to think about it. The Drobo software is handling all of that for me. It even figures out how much storage it needs to account for that redundancy and for future expansion and all those sorts of things. And you can see it all in their software. The software is really great. run it on your Mac, and it gives you a dashboard with everything you need to know. And they have a whole range of products that really meet everyone's needs. They offer devices with 5, 8, even 12 hard drive bays, so you can go from very simple home setups all the way through major enterprise setups. They have solutions for all of that, and you can choose direct connected or network attached solutions. And you don't have to worry about dongles here, because they have models that support every kind of connector that you might have. So you want USB 3, they've got it. It's USB-C, you got a new MacBook Pro, they've got it. Thunderbolt, Thunderbolt 1, Thunderbolt 2, even gigabit Ethernet for your network stuff. And best of all, for MacCast listeners, Drobo is giving you their best deal of the year. You can save 20% or more off the purchase of a Drobo 5N, a network attached system, or the Drobo 5D or 5DT. The DT is the Thunderbolt in USB 3 version, or any 8 or 12 bay unit network system. So 20% or more off of those, that's a savings between $100 and $800 based on the model that you choose. To take advantage of this incredible deal, all you have to do is head over to drobostore.com to purchase your system and enter the code MC20 at checkout, and you are going to get a great discount on a Drobo. And so if you're looking for a storage solution, something for your archives, your backups, just storing your files in general, Drobo will have a solution for you. So go check it out, drobostore.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Big news this past week, the AirPods. We talked about this on the last episode of the MacCast. What did I say? I said, I really hope that Apple doesn't throw these out right at the end of the year with very limited inventory, because I think that's only going to anger their customers even more. And I think the day after that episode, I think it was Tuesday last week, sure enough, Apple says AirPods are available to purchase. Although they didn't make a big announcement, they didn't really tell anybody it was coming. Just 6 a.m. Pacific time, they suddenly showed up on the store. If you weren't there, it was just as I feared. Within 20 minutes, at least here in the U.S., completely sold out, back ordered for 4 weeks, and I think they're now at 6 weeks if you want to get them. So yeah, they got them out in 2016, but really not for the majority of their customers. They made it under the wire for a very small percentage, and everybody else is going to be waiting until 2017, and a few months into 2017 probably to get theirs. Now, the UK seemed to fare a little bit better. They had orders of AirPods still later in the day on launch day, showing a December 21st delivery. So some people are going to have new AirPods under the tree, but a lot of us won't. As a matter of fact, by the time I got up, you know, shame on me, I slept in. I got up about 7:30 a.m. Pacific, sure enough, back ordered for 4 weeks. I got my order in on the AirPods. I was hoping to have them early to review for you all, but it may be a couple months. Now, AirPods are going to reportedly be on sale Monday, probably by the time you hear this podcast, at Apple retail stores. I'm not holding a lot of hope that there's going to be a lot of available inventory. I'm thinking unless you're there right when the UPS guy shows up at that Apple retail store, you're not going to get them. It's going to be like the Apple Pencil all over again. It's going to be a hunt and peck. You're going to have to be right on top of it. And I'm not sure how many people really have time for that. So I just feel like this was a really bad way, once again, for Apple to handle the launch of a product that they know has really large demand. It just doesn't feel good from a customer perspective. And I hope they understand that and think about that for future launches. It feels like they just felt like getting these out because they felt they had egg on their face because they were so delayed, and they wanted to somehow say, yes, we got those AirPods out in 2016. But in my mind, they really didn't get them out, because obviously a majority of their customers are not going to be able to get their hands on them this year. Now, moving on to, I guess, a little more positive news surrounding the AirPods. We're getting details now about replacement costs, about what happens when the batteries go out. If you lose an AirPod, Apple says it's going to cost you about $69 US to get a replacement. And yes, you can replace just one unit. AirPods are going to come with a 1-year standard warranty from Apple. No AppleCare on AirPods, so there's no extending the warranty. You get 1 year of coverage. If you need a new battery in the future for your AirPod, that is going to cost $49 US, and that is for each unit. So you're going to be looking at $100 if you need to replace the batteries in both of your AirPods. Also, $49 if you need to replace the battery in the charging case. And if you need a replacement charging case, you lose it or something happens to it, that is going to cost you $69 US. So AirPods, expensive up front and somewhat expensive in maintenance and in longevity and replacement costs as well. But at least it's a little bit reduced if you just lose one or the charging case or something like that. But that's kind of the update on AirPods. I'm going to keep trying at the Apple retail store to see if I can pick up a pair. I'm not holding a lot of hope, but if I can, look for a review on a future episode of the MacCast. So Microsoft seems to be getting a little bold in some of the statements they're making about their new Surface. In an odd turn of events, Microsoft wrote on their blog that more people are switching from the Mac to the new Surface machines than ever before. Now, Surface hasn't been out for a while, so of course, I'm not sure exactly what this means. They didn't share any numbers. So technically, if one Mac user switched and they never had a switcher before, then technically that would be more, right? Now, of course, the numbers are probably larger than that, but really, what are they? You know, more Mac users are switching to the service than ever before. Well, the service hasn't been out that long, at least in many iterations. So it's probably not a huge statement to make. Although Microsoft has been running a trade-in program for MacBooks, and they say that has really been working to help get Surface sales moving. They also took the opportunity to take a dig at the new MacBook Pro. They say, quote, "The innovation of Surface coupled with the disappointment of the new MacBook Pro, especially among professionals, is leading more and more people to make the switch to Surface." And I'm assuming they're meaning users switching from the MacBook Pro to a Surface Book. And to me, the idea of a Mac Pro user switching to a Surface Book is a little bit laughable. I don't think that is the true Pro machine. This is not the type of Pro Mac user we are talking about using a Surface Book. Just my opinion, though. If you are a Pro user and you have switched to a Surface Book, I'd love to hear from you, learn a little bit more about what you're doing with it and why you made the switch. You can send us some feedback, an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. But as far as Microsoft's statements, you know, maybe not being, I don't think they're not truthful, but I think, of course, it's marketing stuff, right? They're sort of pushing things the way that they want to push them, because recent sales numbers and comments from Apple executives really tell a different story. Slice Intelligence was reporting that in just 5 days, the new MacBook Pro had actually outsold every other high-profile laptop on the U.S. market, and that's for the entire year. So just that machine coming out at the end of the year is selling more units than all the other high-end laptops in the U.S. market. And they also say that sales numbers reached 80% of the combined 2015 and 2016 numbers for MacBook sales, and that Apple sold almost four times as many units as Microsoft's flagship laptop, the Surface Book. So in terms of overall numbers, yes, according to Microsoft, more users than ever are Mac users than ever are switching from Macs to Surface computers. But in terms of overall numbers, it looks like the MacBook is vastly outselling the Surface Book. And Phil Schiller, you remember, also said that the MacBook Pro had set online sales records compared to any other MacBook Pro that they've ever sold. So sell-through is really, really good. So despite all the complaints, despite all the pros who are saying this isn't enough, the MacBook Pro seems to, you know, the Touch Bar ones seem to be selling very, very well. And it, looking at different numbers and comments, it's looking like that is an accurate statement. We'll find out, of course, when Apple announces their next quarterly numbers. Now I want to talk a little bit about some really great analysis from a couple of analysts, Neil Seibert on his blog and Gene Munster in a research note, actually his last research note as a analyst for Gartner. He's going to be moving on to other things. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to start with the comments that were made by Neil Seibert. He wrote about Apple's need to milk and then cannibalize the iPhone. And he was pointing out that, you know, Apple's current strategy seems to be that they're doubling down on the iPhone in the short term. And why would they do that? Because a lot of folks are thinking the iPhone sales have been sort of sliding a little bit. It's not really time to focus on the iPhone. Well, Apple is focusing on the iPhone to help build up their ecosystem for what they're building next. He says Apple's been gradually expanding the iPhone customer base by doing things like offering lower priced models in the lineup, pushing that down, appealing to customers who maybe want larger devices, right? When we saw them size up the iPhone to try and grab more Android customers, that worked very well for Apple. And they're doing all of that while keeping their iPhone profit margins very high. And we've seen that in numbers, right? Apple is doing very well in terms of the sales numbers, in terms of the profit for iPhones, but not just there. Seibert estimates that Apple's current installed base of iPhones is about 700 million iPhones in the market, and that many of the current sales that Apple is doing, those are going to actual new customers, brand new customers to the iPhone, and that's what's important to this overall theory. He says that Apple added 100 million new iPhone customers in 2015, and that in 2016, they should have added even more than that. So 100 million plus customers, new customers to the iPhone in 2016. And he's saying Apple is milking the iPhone so that they can build a formidable ecosystem. And that Tim Cook's success in this area is actually being ignored by a lot of people. All the people that are being critical of what Tim Cook is doing, they're kind of missing the point on this. They're missing what he's doing sort of with this buildup, you know, behind the scenes of iPhone customers. Since he became CEO in 2011, he points out that the iPhone installed base has grown by 500 million users. The iPad installed base has grown by 175 million users. Mac installed base grown by 50 million users. These are all new customers coming into the Apple ecosystem. When they introduced the watch, approximately 18 million Apple watches were sold. And at that point, the device was and still is just positioned as an iPhone accessory. And it could be a lot more. Apple is earning $6 billion a year in revenue through app sales in the App Store. They are just going gangbusters. They're pushing forward with Apple TV, almost 10 million units sold there since they last gave numbers, which was in 2015. So that expect that to be a lot higher. And they're really focused on their services, which help build into that ecosystem. So Apple Pay, Messages, Maps, iTunes, iCloud, all of that stuff building into this large ecosystem. And Apple's continued focus on the iPhone looks odd from the outside. When you're looking at the competition and what they're doing, you're seeing almost everybody else move away from phones. They're not doing phones. Amazon and Google, they're looking at their living room devices, the Alexa and the Home. They're looking at digital assistants as kind of the next big thing. That's what they're showing in their advertising. Microsoft has moved on to the Surface. Touchscreen notebooks and computers is the thing that they're really focused on. And that's kind of odd when you think about the fact that the desktop market and the notebook market continues to shrink at a pretty rapid rate. It's not really a growth industry. So all of these companies, he points out, really want consumers to move on to the next big thing or what they think is the next big thing. But honestly, a lot of, in my opinion, a lot of that technology isn't ready. Most consumers aren't necessarily ready for it. You know, early adopters are there and it may get there eventually, but it's probably not something Apple needs to really focus on or worry about in the short run. The phone is comfortable and familiar to a lot of people, and you know, it's the place where Apple seems to be focusing a lot of their attention still. And again, a lot of people from the outside, that looks odd. I will admit, to me, it looks odd. You know, like, what is Apple doing? Everybody else is sort of getting ahead. But we've seen this before. We've seen Apple focus on, you know, technologies that seem like they're out of date, building up an ecosystem. This is what they did with the iPod. And then they brought in iTunes and slowly built up this giant empire. Similar things with the iPhone. And all of this, of course, doesn't make fans of the Mac happy. And many of them are blaming Tim Cook for the downfall of Apple, right? We've been hearing this over and over again and talking about it. Apple isn't focused on updating the Mac or really even the iPad as frequently, and that's simply because consumers aren't upgrading as frequently. I think we've talked about this as well, but this was brought up in the Seibert article, and I kind of agree with him. They're just not that interested in notebooks and computers outside of some niche folks, you know, pros and certain users like myself. We care about that stuff, but the vast majority of the marketplace is moving on. They're using other devices. They're starting to use their phone as their primary computer or their tablet. And more are, you know, as phones get larger, as screens get larger, they are focused on their phones. And many iPhone owners actually won't even own an iPad or a Mac. There always is some halo effect. Someone comes into the iPhone ecosystem and then maybe decides to buy a Mac or an iPad. But I think that effect is decreasing. I think it's not as impactful as it has been in the past. And, you know, Apple wants to avoid, as Seibert points out, the mistakes it made in the 90s of focusing on just going after profits and really losing touch with the consumer. Now, some Mac users, pros especially, might feel that, you know, this is what's happening now. But what we're really talking about is not going after a bunch of niche users. When Apple started really fragmenting their Mac line in the 90s, it was because they were trying to make a machine that appealed to every small little segment. They're not doing that anymore. They're focusing on products that really appeal to a larger, broader consumer audience. And that's affecting, you know, a lot of us in the community in ways that we probably don't like. But strategy-wise, if you can step back and sort of pull yourself away from that, it starts to make sense what Apple is doing. They're no longer interested in building products targeted at really small niches of the community. And even the MacBook Pro, if you look at that, why a lot of quote-unquote pros are upset is it's designed to appeal to, I think, a broader pro audience. We're talking about writers, we're talking about bloggers, vloggers, you know, these people that machine is targeted very much at. Yes, you know, high-end video editors, 3D modelers, people in the film industry might not see it as a pro computer, but a lot of other groups do. So it's got this broad consumer appeal, and Apple's trying to, you know, they did the best with the technology they had available and built the best possible machine that would appeal to the broadest user base. And again, the sales numbers, as we were talking about earlier, seem to be reflecting that, yes, that was the right decision. But, you know, Apple is always looking to what's next. So not a year from now, not 2 years from now, but probably a little bit further out, what are they going to do and what is going to help them make an impact and sell the most devices when that those technologies are ready? And the argument here with this article is milking the iPhone right now for the next couple of years until that product hits the market is probably the right thing to do, because what you're doing is you're building the base of consumers that you can sell your new device to. And what does the future look like when it comes to especially mobile computing? Well, guess what? It's not touchscreens. It's not mobile phones or smartphones. It's not necessarily even notebooks. Again, notebooks will still be there for certain tasks and for a certain audience, but the larger, quote unquote, computer user or cell phone user, they're going to be using some other technology. and it's going to be a different interface. The interface is changing. We're moving to augmented reality, voice assistants, voice first interfaces. We're not going to be interacting with our devices using our hands. It's most of the time we're moving away from those interfaces, even VR, virtual reality, to a certain extent, and also wearables and transportation technology. Those are the future. Wearables are going to play into the whole AR, VR voice assistant thing. So wearables like AirPods or Apple Watches. And Apple having a massive ecosystem in place will help them dominate those new markets as they transition people from the iPhone to the next thing that's going to cannibalize and take away iPhone sales. And Apple needs to be there making that product. Apple will have to break the iPhone chains at some point to realize this. They're going to have to cannibalize. And likely the device we're talking about is probably multiple devices, something like a cellular Apple Watch. Adding cell phone technology to the Apple Watch, so your thing on your wrist is your heart rate monitor, your health tracker, and your phone, your contacts, and all those sorts of things. And then you have some other interface, an audio interface, maybe through your AirPods, augmented reality glasses or contact lenses to bring up information and present that to you. That's the future we're moving to. And it sounds weird and strange at this point, but really, that's ultimately where we're getting. And the first company that can bring out a really consumer-friendly, acceptable interface for that and experience for that is going to be a winner. And we know that Apple is very good and very careful about making integrated, great consumer experiences. So if they can pull that off and then have this installed consumer base to sell that product to, they're going to be right back on top with innovative, amazing, magical technology. And that's sort of where the Gene Munster piece comes in. He's leaving, I think I mistakenly said Gartner, Piper Jaffray. He's going to be leaving Piper Jaffray. He's starting up a venture capital firm that's actually going to be focused on VR and augmented reality technologies. And he gave his final Piper Jaffray tech note. And in it, he says that he thinks Apple is building up its services to be a key to its future. And if you think about it, services really go to support the iPhone and the iPhone ecosystem, the iOS ecosystem, the Mac ecosystem also to a certain degree. He said it's going to be difficult for Apple to do that, you know, in order for Apple to be considered serious by Wall Street in terms of services, they're going to need to make it 30% of their business. We've been seeing them grow their services business very rapidly. It's actually the only area of growth I think Apple has right now. iPhone's going to go back to growth, I think, in the next quarter. But for right now, the last couple of quarters, it's been all about services. And for Apple to be a significant player in the services space, they're going to have to reach and make it 50% of their business. But again, if you're thinking about this future where we don't have user interfaces, we don't have screens and that sort of thing, services is going to play a massive role in that. You know, where is your data going to live? It's not going to live on a hard drive. It's not going to live in your watch. It's going to live in the cloud. So that's going to be a big deal. He also thinks that Apple will develop a wearable augmented reality device, sound familiar, that replaces the iPhone in the next 5 years or so. So this is all playing into that. And he also thinks that after that, Apple will really target and go after some sort of transportation technology. That's a couple years, you know, that's a little bit further out than the augmented reality wearable sort of thing. And he notes that really creating magic is Apple's key to success. It's the thing that they do with its products and services. And he believes that Apple can recreate that magical feeling with a future product. And I think they can too. You know, a lot of people think Apple's sort of lost their edge, that they're not as innovative as they have been in the past. And I don't think the innovation has left Apple. I think they are working on stuff and we're just in between those major sparks of innovation. And it's not that they're not innovating. They're innovating every day. It's just behind the curtain. It's behind the scenes. We don't get to see it yet because they're not ready to show it to us. But when they do, The key is that they're going to have this massive ecosystem, and they're going to tap into that, and then we will see the whole picture. We will see the game-changing stuff coming from Apple, and they'll be right back at the forefront. So don't give up on them right now just based on everything that they're seeing. I know it's going to be frustrating that Mac updates and those sorts of things are slowing down, but again, that's just a reflection of the consumer market. Whether we like it or not, that's what's happening. And, you know, the idea, I still maintain, when they get around to the transportation services, a lot of people have been talking they're going to build a car. A lot of people have been talking that they're going to build a system that goes into other cars for autonomous driving. I really think, ultimately, they're building a, you know, something bigger, a car service that can tap into that large Apple ecosystem that's been built. And you no longer buy a car. You simply subscribe to the Apple Car service and you call up an autonomous car right when you need it. It shows up, picks you up, takes you where you need to go, takes you to the grocery store, whatever it might be. You can get the right type of car. So, hey, I need to go today. I have to go haul, you know, wood from Home Depot. I need a truck. Well, send me a truck. And away it comes. And I think this could ultimately be a huge game changer. That's the kind of magical thing that Apple likes to do and deliver. And I do have faith that they will do that. So a little more positive, you know, analyst stuff this week, which I thought was great. Some great positive things. And of course, I'll try to have links in the show notes to the original articles, both. Well, Gene Munster's was just a reference. I think it came out through Mac Rumors. And I'll try to give you a link to the piece on Neil Seibert's blog. So look for those in the show notes at maccast.com. And then one last thing for the news for this week, MacBook Pro batteries. As you probably know, a lot of new MacBook, I shouldn't say a lot, a few complaints have been heard from new Apple MacBook Pro owners that they're not getting anywhere near the advertised 10-hour battery life on their new machines that Apple promised them. There were rumors that I think we talked about that the upcoming macOS 10.12.2 update was going to fix some of the battery problems or address some of the battery problems. Well, now 10.12.2 is out and we're hearing reports of people saying, hey, things have gotten a little bit better. I think this has done something. I think it's improved. But Apple actually told Ars Technica that they've taken no specific steps to improve MacBook Pro battery life in the update. So if you've run the update and thought your battery life has magically gotten better, well, that's just your perception or there's something else going on. The update does have fixes and improvements for things like the Apple Watch unlocking in macOS. It does fix the GPU issues that many people were having with the MacBook Pro. So if your screen was going all glitchy and freaking out, that should be taken care of. And it does add support for taking touch bar screenshots. But as far as the battery goes, they haven't really done anything. So why are people reporting issues? Well, there could be a number of reasons. One that I thought about almost immediately is when you first set up your new machine, of course, it's going to be going through and doing spotlight indexing. It's going to be syncing your photos in the background. There's a lot of background processes that kick off and start running that a lot of people don't realize are going on. And that can suck up a lot of energy. It's running the CPU. It's running the GPU, doing image processing and all of that photo indexing, you know. And so you really can't judge, I think, for the first week or so, the battery life of your new machine. You've got to let it kind of run through that stuff, calm down, and then start using it on a day-to-day basis to judge it. Now, I know that's not the case for everyone. They've gotten through that, and they're still having battery issues. Apple did put considerably less battery into the new machines. And this is a function of the thinness that frustrates, I think, a lot of people. Why does it have to be thinner to sacrifice battery? Well, Apple made that choice. They reduced each of the computers by about 25 watt hours. So it's a significant reduction in battery. Now, they're supposed to be more power efficient, but even the new Skylake processors, they're only more power efficient while idling or under light load. If you're running them really heavy, they're still going to be sucking a lot of batteries. So depending upon how you're using your machine, that could be seriously affecting the battery life. And the new GPUs, those new Polaris GPUs, if you have a machine with those also use a bit more power. So less battery, more things to be sucking up power results in less battery life. I think the frustrating point is that Apple is advertising it as being the same as prior generation models. And some have pointed to the new touch bar as maybe being the issue because it's another screen you have to light up. I don't really think that's the case. It's an OLED screen. It's pretty energy efficient and it turns itself off pretty quickly. So unless you've changed those parameters, and I don't even think you can, it's likely not the touch bar that's causing the battery problems. So as you know, I asked anybody in the community who purchased a new MacBook Pro, what's going on? How's your battery life? A bunch of you chimed in, and thank you for your emails and comments. And with very few exceptions, in general, most of you reported that you were experiencing probably between 5 and 6 hours of battery life under your normal usage. Now, that's half. That's still well below the advertised 10 hours that Apple says, but it's not nearly as bad as the 3 hours that we were hearing from some reports. And to be honest, with both my 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro and my new 2015 MacBook Pro, I would say that I'm lucky to get 6 hours of battery life out of it when I'm using it. I don't know how Apple runs its tests. I think it's doing mostly web browsing when they run those 10-hour battery life tests. But, you know, who uses their machine like that? I'm doing podcasts. I'm doing browsing. I'm doing all kinds of things on my machine that could be running down the battery. So to me, 5 or 6 hours is sort of the norm for most machines. So it sounds like the new MacBook Pro is getting what most of us would have gotten with prior generation machines. Maybe I'm crazy in thinking that. If you think I am, you can tell me with a little feedback to maccast@gmail.com. What Apple did do to address the battery issue, though, a lot of people are also not very happy about. If you ran the latest update of Mac OS Sierra 10.12.2, you may have noticed that Apple removed the time remaining estimates from the battery indicator in the menu bar. A lot of people were very upset to see that gone. They complained about it. Apple said the reason they removed it is that it was giving erratic estimates, that it wasn't estimating accurately, and that was causing a lot of the complaints that we were seeing with the new MacBook Pro battery. Whether that is true or not, I'm not super convinced, but it could have contributed to the number of complaints. I think maybe some of those complaints were there and made it seem a little worse, but I don't think that was the overall issue. The reason the estimates seem to be erratic, and they always have been, to be honest, is I think the dedicated GPU and the GPU switching, moving from the internal integrated GPU to discrete GPU, and trying to figure out those times. It's a really big moving target, so it flops back and forth, and it never really was accurate. So it's gone now. Whether or not Apple will ever bring it back, if they can figure out a better algorithm, maybe. Who knows? But if you still need a time remaining estimate on your machine, you could use a third-party app, because a lot of those, like iStat Menu, are great, and they still will have that number. The number isn't gone from the system. It's actually in there, and if you go and use Activity Monitor and look at the Energy tab, you can get the time remaining estimate, but it is no longer available from the toolbar in Mac OS 10.12.2 Sierra. And it's very obvious that Apple is concerned about battery. They want to improve battery life. They want to make sure that things are accurate. So it's no surprise that someone noticed Apple had posted a couple of new job listings last week that seem tailor-made for looking for someone to address their battery issues. They're looking for a battery algorithm analyst engineer and a system power and control architect. So, Apple has a lot of smart battery technology people already on staff, but they're obviously looking for more. So hopefully we will avoid these kinds of problems and issues in the future. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I have a great interview to share with you. I called up my friend Shelley Brisman, writer, author, longtime podcaster. She was there in the early days with me, as you will hear. She wrote a book called iOS Access for All. I'll have a link to where you can get that in the show notes at maccast.com, and she'll tell you about it a little bit later. But she is big in Apple's accessibility community. She's also just big in the Apple community. She's been around for a long, long time, writing and editing for a lot of your favorite Mac sites, many that you would know. But I wanted to get her on because, you know, Apple is big on accessibility, and they really highlighted that fact at the beginning of their MacBook Pro event. They showed this video on accessibility. They talked about it a little bit. So I thought, you know, here at the end of the year, it would be a great time to get Shelley on to discuss more about accessibility in iOS and macOS, get a little update on what Apple's been doing, what they've added this year that's interesting for accessibility, and find out overall, how are they doing? You know, from actually somebody in the community who deals with this stuff on a day-to-day basis. And there's a lot of stuff before you, you know, tune out or say, you know, accessibility, I don't know, really need to know about that or worry about that. Take a listen, because there's a lot of stuff that Apple does with accessibility that actually spills over and benefits all Mac users. We talk about it a lot. You know, there's more and more every day. A lot of the tips that you'll see on Mac sites are stuff that you go in and access through the accessibility menu. So it was a great interview with Shelley. I had a great time having her on the show. So take a listen. Here is Shelley Brisman on Apple and accessibility. Hey, Shelley, how you doing?
Hey, Adam. Great to be here.
Hey, it's been a while. We've known each other a long time, actually.
That's right. We go back to the olden times of podcasting.
Yeah, back in the day, in the early days of podcasting. Yeah. We're both still around, kind of doing our own thing. I know that you're really active in the accessibility side of the podcasting world. And so I wanted to get you on because a number of people in my audience had been asking for sort of an update on, you know, what's going on with accessibility and Apple and the Macintosh. And I figured you were the perfect person to tap.
Sure.
To tap to do that. So I think where I kind of want to start out is maybe just running down, I think a lot of us are familiar with, you know, some of the existing features, but a lot has been going on with Apple and iOS and macOS in 2016. So maybe kind of going through some of the new things that Apple is doing. I know they kind of made a point of highlighting accessibility at the event in September and sort of their efforts there. So I wanted to get the take from someone who's actually closer to it. I mean, what do you think? Are they still doing a good job? Are they still on top of things?
I think they continue to evolve with accessibility. And we always talk about macOS and iOS, which are the main platforms, but we should remember that watchOS and tvOS are really important too, and that Apple has continued to take the accessibility features that we've gotten to know in macOS and iOS and port those over to other platforms. And it's funny because whenever you watch those events and a new product is announced, the first question we in the accessibility community have is, well, is it going to be accessible and to what extent?
Right.
And because Apple has such a long history of doing this, the answer to the first question is almost always yes. The answer to the second question is nobody knows, because we sometimes don't get to play with the toys quite as early as everyone else does, but we put them through their paces when we do. And so the touch bar was a great example of that, where we knew that was happening, but we didn't know what it was going to mean for voiceover users, and which voiceover is the screen reader that's built into all Apple platforms that allows somebody to hear a spoken interface instead of seeing it. And so we were wondering, well, is voiceover going to be part of that new touch interface? And as it happens, it is.
Right.
There are some unknowns for those of us with low vision as to whether it's going to be something that's going to be physically usable because of where it's located on the keyboard, but the feature is there. Zoom is supported. And so we're still learning about that one. And I guess that's kind of the biggest, newest thing, is just that whenever Apple comes up with a new interface, they have to figure out how to incorporate accessibility into it, and they usually do that.
Right. So that's interesting that you brought up the touch bar thing. I think we're just going to kind of bounce around here a little bit, because
sure.
You know, as stuff comes up, I'm probably going to want to ask you about things. So being a low vision user, I had not thought about, you know, the touch bar. So have you had an opportunity yet to play with the touch
bar? I haven't, and I need to do that. It's kind of on my list, and right. because
it's not easy to do.
No, I have to go. I have to go find one, and right. Apple's not necessarily sending out units for us to play with. I know there are a few people who have experienced it with VoiceOver who actually did get their MacBook Pros. Yay! Right. But I haven't. I think the issue for a low vision person is if you physically sit close to the screen,
right.
there might be sort of an awkward physical relationship with the touch bar because of where it is relative to where your hands normally are in the screen. And so that's my biggest curiosity as to how that's going to work. And also whether if I'm going to use vision, my blind friends always tell me, well, just use VoiceOver and it won't be a problem. But if I'm going to use vision, am I going to be able to see the little things on the touch bar and use them effectively? And I don't know the answers to those questions
yet. It's
pretty
small. I think it's about 60 pixels or something like that.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we'll see.
90, I can't remember. I probably should have my stats in front of me. I got it wrong the first time slightly, but I think it was in the horizontal direction. But I had just logistically, if you're close to the screen, you know, people have already commented, just cited users, that where the location is maybe isn't necessarily ideal, because especially if you're a touch typist or something like that, you're looking at, you know, straight at the screen, and the idea of having to actually look down to interact with those buttons because they change, right?
Right.
And I would imagine that presents a whole separate set of challenges for someone who's low vision, who might be really close to the screen. You're looking almost straight down at that point and probably having to move the laptop close. And I could imagine that could be quite awkward.
Which is why I hope that they come up with a magic keyboard that has a touch bar, because then I could put it wherever I wanted to. I've even seen setups where people have their laptop sort of at a 45 degree angle so that it kind of looks awkward to type on, but it's easier to see the screen and maybe interact with the trackpad and the touch bar. And I can see myself coming up with some sort of weird kit so that I could use the touch bar enabled keyboard. But for that reason, primarily, I don't think a MacBook Pro is something I'm going to be getting right away. That doesn't make it a bad machine. It just means that it may not necessarily be for me.
Right. So kind of getting back to what happened in 2016 and some of the features, I'm going to kind of equate this to maybe OS updates just in general. To me, in 2016, Apple didn't do a ton of things in terms of new features. Like, you know, we got macOS Sierra, but a lot of the new features are things like, well, you have to have an Apple Watch to do the sign-on thing, or you need to have a more modern Mac to do some of the continuity sort of new features. So there's some great new features like the clipboard, but they maybe aren't, you know, huge steps forward. So I'm kind of curious, because I don't follow the accessibility community. Were there any kind of big updates that came either to iOS or macOS in 2016 that were like significant new features, or was it all kind of just enhancements to things that Apple already had?
There are a couple of pretty new cool things in tvOS and iOS, and I want to talk about those in just a second. But I think what you say about the metaphor of 2016 being sort of enhancements and tweaks rather than big features, it really is relevant to accessibility in the sense that you can see, if you look at all of Apple's four platforms, that they're unifying the way they address accessibility, where it is in the settings, what things are called. I mean, that just kind of sounds like a basic thing, but in the beginning of tvOS, for example, they didn't have some of the low vision features organized. They didn't have them, period, but they didn't have them labeled in such a way that they were easily identifiable to somebody who was a macOS or iOS user. Mm-hmm. And so as you look through the sets of features, you can kind of see, oh, this is where they're going with that. This is kind of their unified theory of accessibility naming conventions as well as features. And so they did a lot of that in 2016 with the tvOS update this summer. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing. WatchOS 3 did some of that as well. Sierra is probably the OS update this year that had the least accessibility additions. There are a couple of new things in it. Mm-hmm. There's a support for something called dwell control, which if you've seen folks who are quadriplegic or who otherwise are in wheelchairs and don't have use of their hands and arms, they will have head-mounted devices that control switches that allow them to use computers. You saw, I assume, and I'm not certain of that, but in the accessibility video that was in the September presentation, they had a woman who was editing film, and she had a head-mounted device, and I would assume that that is Sierra-based dwell control in Final Cut.
Right.
And so that's pretty nifty for that community. That's a brand-new thing. There's been switch control for iOS and for macOS for some time, and those are relatively unchanged, but dwell control is new for Sierra. And then related to that, there's Switch Control and tvOS now, which is great because folks who you can connect via Bluetooth and use a Switch to control their Apple TVs.
Oh, that's really good. Getting back to what you were just saying, so the naming conventions, like do you have some examples of kind of where they're doing that kind of changing that consistency?
They're organizing. So the low vision, this is sort of really in the weeds, but the low vision settings had been organized all sort of under one category called increased contrast.
Right.
And now there is a separate category that is, I'm actually gonna have to look at it because I can't remember it's still called increased contrast and it has a couple of toggles for that. But the display accommodation is the other one. So what they're doing is trying to differentiate one kind of low vision setting from another. So display accommodation has an actual slider so that you can increase the level of contrast. And so I think by dividing those sets of settings, I'm struggling a little bit here too, because honestly, I can't quite figure out where they're going. I get the sense they're not quite done, but I know they've made the conscious effort to split those up. They've added color filters, which makes it possible for you to change not only the contrast between the background and the text, but the actual colors, because folks with color blindness have some difficulty seeing that. And then they've sort of streamlined the way VoiceOver, the screen reader settings are organized. They're all still under one rubric, but they've reorganized them in such a way that it's easier to find what you're looking for. And then speech, which is used by VoiceOver, but which is also available if you're not a VoiceOver user and you want to use speech for some but not all functions when you're working in macOS or iOS. Mostly it's iOS right now. That's all been organized into its own category so that you don't have to dig into VoiceOver to find the speech options if you're not a VoiceOver user. I'll explain that a little bit. There's a feature in iOS called Speak Screen, which lets you, if you're not using VoiceOver, nonetheless, if Speak Screen is enabled, you can use a gesture to have iOS read what's on the screen to you. It can read an article or it can read just the contents of a screen. And that way you don't have to go all in on the VoiceOver interface and use all the gestures. But I use Speak Screen all the time if I have something on my device and I just want to have an article read to me really quickly. And that, as well as typing feedback and some of the other speech features, are just have been reorganized in such a way that they're easier to find.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I think at one point, and it probably still is assigned, I played around with that Speak Screen feature. It's pretty cool. And I may even have it, you know, set up on the triple click home thing still. So that's a great tip, even, you know, for people who aren't using it for accessibility reasons.
Well, the nice thing about Speak Screen is you don't even have to put it on the triple click home. All you have to do is enable it, and it won't bother you until you do a 2-finger downward flick to activate
maybe
it
that's
to make
it
start.
Yeah, it has like its own gesture.
Yeah.
Very cool.
And that's one of the reasons that I really like to use it, because it kind of stays out of my way. Since I don't need to be a daily VoiceOver user, I don't need most things read to me, but every once in a while, I want something read to me. Typing feedback is the same way. So if I'm typing, I can have it read back to me. I don't need it to read back every character to me, but I might want it to read words to me. So for example, if I'm out in sunlight where it might be a little difficult for me to see my screen, I can turn on typing feedback, and when it finishes a word, I'll get confirmation that I actually typed what I meant to type.
Right.
No more damn you autocorrect stuff, you know. not so much of it. It still happens.
Yeah, well, autocorrect, I think, gets in everybody's way very often.
Does.
So it seems like it'd be easier to swipe away. The biggest issue I have with autocorrect these days is when I'm trying to type Apple's own product names on my iPad using the smart keyboard. It's almost impossible to get it to do a lowercase character using the smart keyboard at the front of the thing.
That's,
and I don't know why. You know, I'm like pressing shift to try and get it, you know, and your cap locks, and nothing's working. So it's just like,
I use a lot of text expander snippets for those things. I type iOS an awful lot.
I should be using that. Yeah, I should switch over to my text expander keyboard. That's a good tip too. I never thought about that. I don't know why, but it's obvious when someone usually tells you about it. So any other kind of key new features that were added this year that maybe stood out to you?
Sure. Well, let's talk about iOS had not an enormous number, but a few more than Sierra did. Mm-hmm. There is a new feature called Magnifier. You've probably seen in the App Store, maybe you haven't, but there are all sorts of little apps out there that essentially turn the camera into a magnifying glass.
Right.
So you can look at small text, and they put a zoom slider right there on the screen. Well, Apple has created its own, and its two unique features are, one, you can add it to the triple-click accessibility shortcut so that if you want to have access to Magnifier, it's not an app. It's actually built into iOS.
Right.
So you can say, you can either triple-click and get right into Magnifier or triple-click and add it onto the menu. The second thing is that the color filters I was talking about, which can be used to view the whole iOS screen, can be applied to the Magnifier as well. And that's a feature that comes directly from what's called CCTVs or handheld electronic magnifiers. Low vision people use those devices to read text or even do distance reading. But if they have difficulty with existing color contrast, or if it's easier for them to see a light text on a dark background, for example, they would use these color schemes that are built into these magnification devices. And Apple has now added those to the Magnifier feature, as well as making them available just in general with color filters for low vision users.
Yeah, that's another cool feature that, again, I think people even outside the accessibility community can really benefit from it and use. So, and I think it's hard for people to forget that accessibility isn't just for a certain group in a lot of cases, right? Accessibility is just about making things more accessible for everyone.
Yeah, well, that's the theory, I think, of something like Magnifier, because you might not have a Magnifier app on your iOS device, as I do,
right,
but you might come across some small text that it would be great to zoom in 16 times. And no, I haven't looked at, say, the iPhone 7 Plus camera with the telephoto lens. Maybe I can see, you know, itty-bitty things with it, but I that's another thing I'm going to do when I go to the Apple store, is see whether that super snazzy camera affects Magnifier. But yeah. And the other funny thing I'll say about sort of accessibility features that mainstream folks use, I guarantee you that if you ever see an article called 10 secret features in iOS, at least half of them will be inside the accessibility settings area, because people don't know, they don't think about it. They think, I'm not a person who uses accessibility, so I don't have to go into that section of settings. And so there are all kind of features that
right.
exist that are probably helpful at least some of the time, if not all the time, whether you have a disability or not.
Yeah, yeah. And that was kind of what I was getting at. It seems like more and more we have to start kind of making it known that this isn't just for this one subset of users. It shouldn't be siloed like that mentally. And I know I've struggled with, you know, kind of changing my mindset on that. You know, it's like, this is just something that's built into the operating system. It is another feature, just like any other feature that Apple might add.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that was kind of a big one, I know. Trying to think of any other ones in iOS.
A couple, they're big for some people, not for others, I guess. But
right.
VoiceOver in the speech engine generally now has this thing called the pronunciation editor. So if you have a word that is being spoken to you with VoiceOver, the speech interface, that's not being pronounced consistently correctly, you can go in there and you can phonetically spell it out, or you can even say it until iOS gets it right and you can save it as a pronunciation.
Well,
and being
cool.
Married to somebody with four syllables in their last name, I really enjoy it. So,
wow. I want that for Siri. Can I have that for Siri?
I know, right? That'd be fun. Everybody should get a pronunciation editor.
She's constantly...
She just says terrible things.
Directions, saying the wrong... Well, especially when you live in an area where there's a lot of Hispanic, you know, Spanish kind of sounding things. She gets those incorrect very frequently.
So. Right. Well, the funny thing is that the fact that it exists in the speech engine means they could theoretically open it up to Siri, because...
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder whether that might sort of be a test, like, okay, we'll make this thing and see if it works, and we'll have the accessibility testers test it, and then maybe if they like it, maybe we'll let other people use it. I don't
yeah.
know.
Hope and I think she actually, in a way, kind of has that. I think a feature a lot of people don't know is that when you ask Siri for a response and it comes back up on the screen, I think you can tap to edit it, and I think now they've added the ability to... highlight specific words and then say, okay, this is not how you say this. And
that seems familiar.
Correction yeah. back to Apple. I know you can do it at least for like names in your contacts, right? If she comes back, or your own name, you can say, that's not how you say Brisbane, right?
Right. For and example. I wonder if it would be sort of nice. I guess if it goes back to Apple, everybody will get it, but it would be nice if you could maintain a dictionary of that stuff for yourself and then
it's
also
locally,
choose to share it if you wanted. Yeah.
If it was
Which is what
like,
pronunciation editor does for you. I don't think it syncs that stuff across devices. I'm not certain, but it would be kind of cool.
Yeah, probably not, because of the whole privacy thing that Apple's very concerned about.
Yeah. And then I guess, let's see, we talked about, there's some smaller features for VoiceOver. Braille did not support 3D touch, and now it does. And I mention things like that because sometimes in accessibility, there will be kind of a delay. Like 3D touch comes out, it's only on a couple of phones, so the number of folks who are using it with a Braille display is going to be less than the overall population by a long shot. But then Apple comes out with its second generation of phones that support 3D touch, so we better find a way to add that gesture or add that key combination to Braille displays as well. And so there are a few things like that where Apple kind of cleaned up stuff where they hadn't, you know, they don't always get it right the first time, and they're often accessibility bugs. And the challenge with accessibility bugs is there aren't as many folks testing as there are the mainstream stuff. Although there is, you know, I hasten to point out, there absolutely is a fairly significant accessibility testing program, but bug fixes, I guess it's true in the mainstream world as well, but bug fixes are always pretty high on the list of things that go into a new OS, and that's certainly true with accessibility for iOS 10 too.
So is that the kind of thing where you would activate 3D touch with the Braille display, and then just that pop-up that would come up, it wouldn't be able to read or access the data that's in that sort of pop-up? Is that kind of where
The gesture didn't exist for the Braille display, so there was no way to activate.
You're activating it
on the Braille display. Now you could activate it on your iOS device, and then the readout would be available to you on your Braille display, but this allows you to activate it from the Braille display.
Oh,
and then you can either interact with it on the display, which is probably what you do, or on the device.
I mean, I just could imagine that a lot of times maybe some of the bugs that surface are things like that, where Apple's added a new feature and there's just literally for like VoiceOver, like a part of the screen that it's not recognizing or not accessing because it's like a submenu or a pop-up or some, you know, off area that they didn't sort of account for.
That does happen. Fortunately, not so much with Apple apps as it used to. Every once in a while, that will happen. And it's usually sort of the minor apps, the ones that are in the extras folder kinds of things.
Right.
And third-party apps, that's certainly a big problem because you'll have things that are either not known to VoiceOver at all or that are labeled button. It's button, button, button. And the user actually has the ability to go back and, you know, label those buttons, but that's not an ideal way to do it.
Right.
So.
Right.
That usually when you're interacting with third-party app developers, if the app is mostly VoiceOver compatible, you can say, you know, that button in the lower right, which I think is settings, could you please just put a label on that? That would be nice. And often they will. So
that actually brings up another question on the sort of general state of accessibility here in 2016. I know it's always been somewhat of a challenge, you know, in the Mac community, because Apple provides the tools, a lot of developers do support accessibility, but it's probably never where the community would really want it to be. How is it just generally the state of that with third-party developers? Are they still doing just as good a job? Are things getting better? You know,
I think
in general, it's
pretty good. I think the default state is at a higher level. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that every app you want to be accessible is. And then, unfortunately, the worst thing that tends to happen is somebody will have an accessible app, and then they'll do an update that will unintentionally break accessibility.
Right.
And if you have set to auto-update as a user, you could be out of luck if you end up applying an upgrade that doesn't work. Fortunately, the best way to combat that is to hang out on Twitter a lot and see if other people are complaining before you upgrade to the latest version of XYZ software. But that's not the best way in the world, but it's what's out there. And then, you know, there are sites out there that are trying to catalog this stuff and say, you know, beware, don't download the latest version of X until they get this accessibility problem fixed. But I think overall the default state is improving, and I don't know that there are really egregious bad actors. Hopefully, in most cases, if an app isn't accessible, there's an alternative app in the same category that is.
Right.
That isn't enough, and I always want to go to a developer and say, hey, I'd really love it if you'd make your app accessible, even if there are four other apps that do something similar, because I might have a very good reason for wanting to choose your app, and I'd like to be able to give you my money, and if you make it accessible, I'll be happy to do that.
Yeah. And like I said, I mean, hopefully, you know, dependent upon how it's developed, I think is another big factor, just like it is for other reasons. You know, Apple adds features and things at a core OS level that, you know, I would imagine with accessibility, if you just develop it sort of, you know, the Apple way or the recommended way, even if you haven't implicitly gone in and tried to make certain things accessible, at least things, basic things like basic functionality of VoiceOver, other features are in sort of enabled by default. You know, if you're using standardized controls versus building custom controls is kind of the example that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, you do need to label everything. So you may be using standard controls, but you do need to make sure you use your accessibility labels. And there are a couple of other APIs that you want to be aware of as you're going through. I don't want to get too far into this because I will be out of my depth not being a developer. You're going to know way more about that than me. And I also want to hasten to point out that when I say the state of the art is better than it used to be, I'm speaking mostly of iOS. Sometimes you have a tendency when you're doing this kind of stuff to forget the Mac.
Right.
And I want to say that both the breadth of apps that are available for the Mac, just how many there are out there from how many different places, means that your accessibility luck on the Mac is often not as good as it is on iOS. Most of the major applications that you're going to rely on are going to be accessible. But every once in a while, you'll come up upon something that you really want to use that isn't, and for inexplicable reasons.
Right.
And it sometimes might be because there haven't been enough people in the community who have gone out to contact that developer, and the developer just doesn't know. I get the sense that iOS developers are more aware of that, and that there probably is more of a critical mass around, especially blind and visually impaired folks that are using iOS than are even using the Mac.
Right.
And again, on the Mac, there are more alternatives. I have a couple favorite apps that I really like that are not particularly VoiceOver friendly. And so I always have to, it's funny because I have to check that. I don't use VoiceOver on the Mac daily either.
Right.
And so, when I recommend an app to my blind friends, I always have to go make sure it's VoiceOver compatible. I've been embarrassed a couple times because I've recommended an app and then there's this long pause and they're like, well, it's not accessible. That's very embarrassing
work with
for somebody
VoiceOver.
Like me.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I guess we were talking about features. I want to mention one last one just because we hadn't really gotten to watchOS yet. But
right.
I guess the biggest watch feature, watchOS 3 has been very popular in the blind visually impaired community for a number of reasons, just because it's better in general. But Taptic Time is a really big one. So if you double tap a sleeping watch, it will actually give you taptic feedback to tell you the time. And I know a lot of people, because the alternative is with VoiceOver to have your watch speak. And you might be in a meeting or class or something and you don't want to watch to speak. So Taptic Time has been really helpful to folks.
You know, and maybe it's just because I don't live in that world. I can never get, like, because you have Taptic directions too, right? You know how
right.
you have those taps. I still am not very good, even, you know, here year and a half on with my Apple Watch at even detecting just a left right. So it amazes me the people that can, and I know they can do it. I know it can be done, and I probably could learn if I would spend some time with it, but I can't tell when it's, you know, doing three fast ones or, you know, like,
it's like being able to read Morse code with your wrist somehow.
Right.
It's like,
yeah, I'm not. I guess I don't have those subtle senses enough, but I guess you can develop them. It's like one of those superpowers that I wish I had that a bunch of other people have.
Well, motivation, you know.
So do you use that feature? Can you actually tell the time using the Taptic Time thing?
I am actually not an Apple Watch owner.
Oh, okay.
My friends who are swear by it, though.
They say it works great. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's another cool new feature. And again, it's something that even a non-visually impaired user could probably benefit from. You know, you're
totally
in the theater. You want to have your watch just not have to turn on to see
yeah.
the time.
And there's an accessibility shortcut equivalent on the watch, too. So I believe in order for that, I think I'm somebody's going to correct us if we're wrong. So
sure.
Go ahead,
they
people.
Always will.
I believe you need to have VoiceOver enabled for that to work. And in that case, you would want to be able to turn it off quickly if you weren't a continuous VoiceOver user. So I guess that would be the only hitch, is that you need to remember to turn VoiceOver on. But again, somebody correct me. I may not be right about that.
The other thing I found interesting was you mentioning that accessibility is sort of further along on iOS, or it feels like there's more stuff there. And, you know, on one side, it's kind of interesting to me because I would think, well, the Mac's been around longer, accessibility's been on the Mac for longer, you'd think it'd be bigger there. But then at the same time, you think about, well, it's really critical on a touchscreen device because it's a touchscreen device, right? I mean, you need to
yeah.
have more accessibility there because you don't have physical buttons and things to actually do interactions.
I think that's it. I think that when they iOS didn't have accessibility to begin with, but when it came out with accessibility, there was a lot of it, and you couldn't do it halfway. You really had to make it a fairly robust interface. It's obviously continued to improve, but probably because you had to have so much, that's the perception. It's not that iOS is more accessible, it's that the change is coming faster. So once the Mac got accessibility, a lot of the Finder stuff and a lot of the things that are just built into the system overall were quickly accessible. And then it remained for Mac developers to become accessible. And they've continued to add voiceover gestures and functions. And there's several sort of ways to shortcut voiceover interaction, especially with touchpads and things like that, force touch and all that sort of stuff that they have added to macOS. But I think the perception probably, again, I think it's because though there are lots of folks who are using the Mac and VoiceOver, I think like everybody else, the blind and visually impaired and all folks with disabilities are migrating toward mobile. And there are a lot of reasons that have to do with the desirability of mobile overall. And there are a lot of accessibility reasons because mobile devices are not only our phones and an alternative to computers, but they have supplanted a lot of accessibility specific devices that people used to use. And so they're like, well, you know what? I'll just put all my eggs in the phone basket or in the iPad basket and I'll spend less time at my Mac, which is kind of what a lot of people are doing.
Yeah. Well, and like it's the same thing that we're doing with everything, right? Is we don't have point and shoot camera, you know, most people don't have point and shoot cameras anymore and you don't have you know, maybe a separate telephone. So it even makes more sense if you're a type of person who's relying on a lot of these highly specialized devices that can suddenly be consolidated and reduced to this one thing that you're going to be already carrying anyway. That just makes a lot of sense.
And again, I think the voiceover, there wasn't so much necessarily to do. There are things that the Mac could still do, not even so much with voiceover. I think with low vision, there's still movement. The fact that they've just added dwell control, there are probably some nut and bolt type things that they can do to support peripherals for folks with motor disabilities on the Mac. And let's not underplay the fact that Siri on the Mac is a great accessibility feature. I order my Mac to do all sorts of things with Siri, and I kind of think of it as an accessibility thing. It's not perfect. It's, you know, first generation and all that stuff. And Touch ID, opening with a watch and unlocking with a watch and having Touch ID on the new MacBook Pros. Those kinds of things are mainstream features that function as accessibility features for Mac users.
Right. So I think that where I want to maybe kind of finish off is, you know, Apple's always been sort of on the forefront of this and a leader, but we talked a little bit in the pre-show, you know, there's other people out there, there's other actors out there, other devices out there that have often been, you know, in the past sort of considered to be behind what Apple's doing. What's the general state? Is Apple still ahead of the curve or they sort of, are others catching up? What's going on there?
Others are really catching up, and I have to call out Microsoft here for a couple of reasons. Microsoft, for those who don't have background in this, has always had a tool called Narrator, which is a built-in screen reader, but that was never a full-functioning screen reader. People would use, in the quote-unquote old days, and it's still available, would buy a screen reader called JAWS, which is quite expensive, or they would use NVDA, which is a free screen reader. There's several screen readers out there for Windows that are far more robust. Narrator has never been a full-featured screen reader. But what Microsoft has done, both with Narrator on Windows and with other accessibility tools on all of its platforms, they're really up in their game, especially now. They hired some very major people in the accessibility world from the National Federation of the Blind recently that are leading their accessibility efforts and are being the public face of those efforts. In fact, they just released a roadmap for what they want to do with accessibility in 2017. And that's not something Apple is ever going to do, unfortunately. And I think a lot of the challenges Apple has right now in maintaining their lead are going to be signaling what's coming. Even if it's not specific in terms of features, people who moved away from Microsoft, even in environments where Microsoft was a dominant platform, people who said, if I go to the Mac, I can save you money because even though the computers cost more, or iOS, even though the devices cost more, I don't have to buy accessibility add-ons. That advantage is going to become less compelling unless Apple finds a way to communicate its direction with accessibility, because people are now able to look at Microsoft and Google too, in terms in their mobile devices, because they're actually telling what they're going to do and what their directions are. And I think that's going to be the real challenge for Apple, because now they're having to answer questions that they never had about accessibility, have had to about accessibility, because Apple has always been the gold standard freely available accessibility. They've always supported the developers who want to make tools accessible. And even if Apple maintains its commitment, they're going to have to do more than tell great stories of how accessibility is being used now. They're going to have to do a little more show and tell about what they plan to do. And especially if we expect Apple to make revolutionary changes in the OS platforms and even in their hardware, as they do things like the Touch Bar and as they go more and more toward new interfaces, I think they're going to have to find a way to put accessibility out on that leading edge so that people will continue to have confidence in them.
Yeah. How does accessibility work in, and maybe it works better in some cases, but there's probably more challenges. How does it work when we move into more screenless interfaces and you know, things like augmented reality, virtual reality, and all these other things that people are talking about?
It's a huge challenge. And it's funny because from my perch here, I talk to a lot of people about accessibility, but I also have the pleasure of being on a lot of podcasts and talking to a lot of people about mainstream stuff. And we end up talking about augmented reality and VR. And I can approach it from my perch as a pundit, right, but there's a big part of me that says, I don't know what it's going to mean for me personally, because I don't have any sense of how and whether entities are going to facilitate accessibility. What I sometimes end up doing is talking in platitudes about how if VR was handled right or augmented reality was handled right, I would be able to create experiences for myself that I could never have in real life, right, because I would be, you know, safely able to navigate using a computer and a mobile device and a headset and the like. But I don't know whether and how long from now those tools are going to be available to me. And so some of it is not knowable. But some of it is also the sense that accessibility isn't thought about until a technology is mature enough that there are actually products out there in the world. And so I would love to know whether those new paradigms are already including accessibility, or whether we're going to have to wait to see more stuff out in the wild before people start demanding it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about like augmented reality, too. I think they're probably more likely on in front of it, you would hope or imagine. But you know, who really knows? But just thinking about what they're doing with their artificial intelligence technologies and sort of real-time processing of images and things like that, you know, the ability to maybe have a real-time audio descriptive, you know, sort of functionality could be something that's actually not too challenging, because they're already working on the technologies that would support something like that for other reasons, right?
So. Yeah. Probably you're going to have some developers and some visionaries who think about it in those terms, because sometimes accessibility is thought of as a way to make it possible to do things that you can't otherwise do with your physical limitations. But with augmented reality, you could create experiences that are needed by folks who have accessibility challenges, but aren't needed necessarily by a person with normal vision, for example, like a real-time, you know, an immersive flight simulator or some sort of immersive virtual experience. Or, you know, I could create a virtual experience where I'm performing surgery or something like that, so that I would know what that experience was like, for so I could learn anatomy or something. And that may not be an experience that would be created the same way for you as it would be for me, because my vision is limited. So they might do things to give me information not with color, but give it to me with text or give it to me with voice.
Right.
And those aren't experiences that are being, you know, altered for my benefit. Those are experiences that might be created for my benefit if I'm a student, or if I'm somebody who's training for a career, or just somebody who wants to play a really cool game.
Yeah. Wow. Lots of stuff to think about. It's very interesting stuff. I just had not really considered much about the future, but now I am.
So I don't sit around and think about it all that often either. So it's kind of fun to have these conversations, because like if you're in the real world, if you're thinking about, well, these are the bullet points, these are the things that iOS introduced,
right,
you can say, well, here's what we already have. But that's also kind of a luxury, or the great thing about thinking of the in terms of the future and thinking sort of big and broad, because again, accessibility is often thought of as a Band-Aid for something that's missing, as opposed to an opportunity to create something like totally new that I hadn't even thought about until this minute, trying to, you know, struggle for an example in my head. Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully Apple's thinking the same way.
I hope so.
They got a lot of smart people there, so I'd imagine that they are. Well, thanks, Shelley. I want to really say I appreciate you coming on to kind of give us this little update and stuff like that. Before I let you go, I know you have a book and you have some other things that you're doing. Can you tell our audience, you know, where they can sort of follow you, what you're up to, and a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, first of all, Adam, thanks so much for having me. Always enjoy the MacCast, and it's good to see those of us who have been podcasting for a really, really long time still hanging here. In there. So you can follow me on Twitter at Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-Y. I wrote a book called iOS Access for All, Your Comprehensive Guide to Accessibility for iPad, iPhone, and iPod Touch. I published the iOS 10 edition, which is the fourth edition of this book, in October. You can find that at my website, which is iosaccessbook.com. You can buy it in EPUB or PDF format, or even from the iBook store. All the links are there. You can download a sample chapter, read the table of contents. But the basic idea of the book is I cover all of the accessibility features in iOS, and it's organized according to type of disability. So if you're only interested in motor disability or hearing impairment or low vision, there's a chapter there for you. $20, not so much to ask. I also do a podcast called The Parallel Podcast. I'm really proud of it. It's at parallelpodcast.com. And what I do is I bring a guest from the mainstream technology community and another guest from the accessible technology community together. And we talk about tech. We don't necessarily talk about accessibility. We always know it's going to come up, but right. We might talk about gaming. We might talk about parenting or CES or a topical thing like the Apple TV release, which we did a while back. And my goal is to get people who don't normally talk to one another to talk, but not necessarily about accessibility, so that nobody feels like, oh, I don't know anything about accessibility. Why would I go on that show? Well, we don't want you to feel that way. We'll always want you to feel like this is an interesting topic. This is an interesting conversation that anybody can be can listen to, whether they have accessibility interests or not, but it's going to come up. And that's at parallelpodcast.com. We have a really fun show recording this weekend. So sign up before the year is over to get the fun end of year show that I won't tell you more about. And last but not least, my blog is brisbane.net. where I advertise all this stuff and all of my many appearances on podcasts, and where I wrote a poem about the MacBook Pro the other day. So if you want to read that, then you could.
I'm intrigued. And that's enough. Plugs. I will go check that out.
Oh, well, there will be a dramatic reading on a podcast in a very few days. But that's at brisbane.net, and that's plenty of plugs for me.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Shelley, again.
Thank you, Adam.
There you have it, Shelley Brisbane. Be sure to check out her podcast, her book, her website. You got all the information there that you need. But I think with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF, Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can check out all of their great applications, get more information and details by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at CashFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails and your audio comments. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me at Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page, over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you can check out the Google Plus community. That's at google.com/PlusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.